It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
Well, I have kind of a sad story for you this morning. It's a little funny, but it's kind of sad. It's a story about a girl who collected dolls, and she had a lot of friends who collected dolls. How many of you have dolls? A lot. All right. Well, somehow in their neighborhood, they decided to have a pretty face doll contest. And they all got very serious about this, and they wanted to enter their prettiest dolls in the pretty face doll contest. And the kids really got into it, and some were even buying like little toy hair dryers that blew a little bit of air out because they think it would fluff up the doll's hair and maybe soften the doll's skin and all this. Well, this girl really wanted to win. More than anything, she wanted to win. So when she saw other kids getting the little toy hair dryers and saw that they did kind of fluff up the doll's hair a little bit, she decided to just sort of supersize it. And she had her mother buy her a really powerful hair dryer, one of those hot ones with a lot of air. And she'd blow it, and it would just about blow her doll's hair off. It was so strong. And it was very warm. And the other girls saw that, and they thought, well, I want one too. But their mothers wouldn't buy them one. They said, that's too dumb. So as the little girl would blow hot air all over her doll's hair, the other girls would just sort of stand behind her. Because there was so much hot air blowing around that some of it would blow their way, and they would just sort of stick their own doll's hair in the way, and everyone would be getting their doll's hair blow-dried by this powerful hair dryer. This made the first girl unhappy because all she really wanted was to win with her doll. She really had no interest in helping anyone else's doll look better. So she came up with an invention. She took the newspaper from the day and she made kind of a big funnel out of the newspaper. And she put the funnel around her hair dryer, and she put the other end of the funnel just over her doll's head. Then she turned it on full blast so that all the hot air would go only to her doll's face. And she left it that way for the 15 minutes before the contest and the judging began. And when she took the funnel off, she discovered that all that hot air had sort of melted all her doll's hair into the face, so it looked like the whole doll's face was covered in hair. And then to make it worse, it had kind of melted the plastic in the face, and the doll's cheekbones and nose had all kind of melted together into what looked like a giant pig nose. But it was too late because the judging had begun. And the judges came down and they looked at each doll. And then they got to this thing. And they didn't know what to do. They were nice judges and they were trying to find a way to give some kind of a present and reward to every doll that was entered. And they'd give one a reward for best hair, best dress, prettiest nose. But they were all out of awards to give out, and they had no idea what to do with this thing. They weren't even sure what it was. So finally, one of the judges, deciding that he would try to be nice to this little girl who had entered whatever on earth it was that she'd entered, went back and made up a special certificate for her. And he came out and very proudly presented her a certificate for first prize for Hairy Pig in a Dress. This made all the other girls very happy. It didn't make the first girl happy, and she took her hairy pig in a dress home with her certificate. And that night, she and her hairy pig in a dress slept together, and they thought that of all the days that they'd had, this had not been a particularly good day for the little girl, and it had been an absolutely horrible day for the hairy pig in a dress. And that's the end of the story. From many lives we have gathered here this morning, let us find our centers that we may enter into a common worship. From many beliefs we have worked our way here. Let us hold lightly to them, that doors may be opened toward new possibilities. Many hopes have brought us here. Let us take the responsibility for our own hopes rather than expecting others to fill them. Many fears attend those hopes. Let us gain strength from this meeting that we may face them with courage and persistence. Much more has entered with us this morning as well, hopes, yearnings, and fears not yet ready to be put into words. Let us be gentle with them and entrust them to the silence that they may grow quietly and bloom in their own time. We remember in prayer this morning those names which we now speak aloud or in the silence of our hearts. This is the fifth in a series of sermons I've been doing on different approaches to belief. Even though it would be easy to do 100 sermons on the varieties of religious experience and belief, this will end the series for this year. So far, I've talked about religious beliefs expressed in God language, expressed in rational or scientific language, or in mystical styles. Last week I talked about reclaiming some of the feminine symbols of religion and life. These are four very different directions. And I know people who think that they're all mutually incompatible. If you believe God is a kind of being who created the universe in a few days, then you'll have trouble bringing very much science into your faith or the beliefs of religions that don't use gods, like Buddhism or Taoism. If you read the New Testament and you've read very much of St. Paul or most of the testosterone-flavored parts of the Bible, your religion may look a lot like patriarchal misogyny. If you agree with Freud that religion is just a lump of childish illusions, or agree with many who have elevated science into a kind of religion, then nearly all the world's religions will just be bunk, and religious mystics will be little more than unhinged neurotics, maybe worse. You get the idea. And while we may all wish that our faith, at least, could be as big as the whole world, never true. And there's something disturbing about us that enters here, because something in us, it seems, wants to be small, wants to join a club of like-minded people, and wants to keep life little enough to be comfortable. Anthropologists may observe that cultures are held together, after all, through conformity, not dissent. But that's another way of saying that something in us is a sucker for a group identity, for a religion of the masses. And we get a group identity by behaving and being like the others, not by doing our own thing. Every religion has its own version of a religion for the masses. We're not immune from this. If you look on the back cover of your order of service this morning, you'll see the creed of our own movement's religion of the masses. It's identified as the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism, even as we pride ourselves on having no creed. Unitarian Universalism isn't a historical religion. It didn't even exist until about 15 or 20 years ago when it was concocted. That doesn't mean there's nothing to statements like this. It just means that it's important to understand what there is to them and what there isn't. The seven statements are innocuous enough, and if you read them, you'll see they're a pretty fair description of how almost all cultural liberals in this country feel about things, whether they go to church or not. But they aren't your real beliefs. You can join a club by reciting sentiments together, but you can't grow an authentic religion that way. That takes work. I'm not against rituals. We do some together here. I start and end the services with the same words every week. And we say the words for lighting and extinguishing the flame together. It helps us feel like a community, and that's a good thing. But I know, and you know, that it's unlikely that the chalice lighting words really express the deepest yearnings of your soul. They speak to the kind of intellectual or spiritual ballpark within which we meet to see if we can actually work toward discovering what we really believe. And that job is harder and takes a long time. We live in a good time to be trying it. We live in a time of religious and cultural pluralism that is unprecedented. It's presented in the press often as a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. Every one of us here, and everyone you know, holds some heretical beliefs for which we could legitimately have been burned at the stake 500 years ago. We have backed off, as a culture, from almost all orthodoxies in a way that we've never backed off from them before. At one of the meetings of the Jesus Seminar 3 weeks ago in California, I heard more talk of Socrates and the Buddha than I did about Jesus. Now that's new. The very fact that we can do a series of sermons talking about expressing beliefs in God talk or scientific talk or mystical talk or with feminine or masculine symbols shows that we have backed way off and are standing outside every one of those beliefs. We're looking at them as idioms of expression, as tools, wondering whether they're useful. That's very different. I took a poll here about a month ago when I asked how many of you thought that religion was about God, period. There were about six. Group. How many of you thought the word God was useless and shouldn't even be used anymore? There were about nine. And how many of you were pretty much comfortable with any way of talking, God language or other language, as long as it seemed honest and coherent and addressed some of your important questions and feelings? And that was everybody else in the room. That kind of freedom of expression, that freedom from any feeling that you have to fit inside of a religious orthodoxy, is a new style of being religious in America, and it's quite public. A few months ago, I talked with you about a book I still think is provocative, a new book called The Cultural Creatives, How 50 Million People Are Changing the World. The book was the result of about 13 years of studying how Americans see themselves in the world, what their world picture is, what's their worldview, And the results showed that a revolution is going on that we don't seem to be aware of. About a quarter of the adults in our country, or around 50 million people, can no longer really be defined within religious orthodoxies or the so-called traditional values of 50 years ago. This huge group of people, whom the authors call the cultural creatives, have a lot in common. They value individual rights. They value care of the environment. Their approach to religion is open-minded and diverse and adventurous. They aren't seeking God as much as they are searching for an authentic life. And in this search, they draw freely from the offerings of any and all of the world's philosophies and religions in a way we've never before done. Some of it is because we have more of the world's philosophies and religions available to us through television and books than we ever had before. But one measure of this change, and I think it's a monumental change, was the fact that in 1998 and 99, the year the Disney studios spent millions promoting their hit movie, The Lion King, The Lion King was not the top-selling video of the year. The top-selling video of the year was an instructional video on yoga. And of the 10 best-selling videos that year, 3 were on yoga. People are as religious as they ever were, maybe more so. But now a huge number of people are coming to realize that they have unprecedented freedom and are feeling free to use it openly. We make our own religions in a large extent using our own inner longing as a compass, and we trust that compass. 2 years ago, 3 yoga videos outsold every Christian, Jewish, and Muslim video in America combined, and probably tripled. This is an American spirituality that is the beginning of a very healthy and underestimated revolution. And we're a small but important part of that revolution. We meet here with just a few hundred people in our 2 services on Sunday. But the truth is, there are tens of thousands of people in the Austin area whose religious questions match ours, and who would love to find a church like this if only they believed one could exist. Luckily, like most Unitarian churches, this is a well-kept secret. But you all have friends and acquaintances who would just love this place, and I want you to tell them and to invite them to church. You bet I'm proselytizing. Why? Why am I selling this? Why do I care whether you spread the good news about an eclectic style of being religious that takes you more seriously than it takes ancient orthodoxies? Because I think that this American style of spirituality is both the logical conclusion of and the legitimate heir to orthodox religions for an absolutely huge number of people, something approaching 50 million. And I want them to have a chance to discover it as we have. Religions, after all, can be dangerous things. They're all like players holding little pieces of a cosmic puzzle. And once they find a little piece, they cling to it with a death grip. And what we need are not firm grips on tiny pieces, but a glimpse of the whole, a feel for the overall picture that transcends and includes all religions. It's the failure to sense that whole that makes our little religious fetishes both comical and destructive, as in the children's story this morning. There are so many stories about this. That children's story was a variation on a very, very old Buddhist story. I'll tell you the original version of it later this morning. I want to share a few other stories. I've used the ancient Hindu image of the world as an elephant, and all of us as blind people who've got hold of just one little part of the beast. And we confuse our little part with the whole beast, and sometimes it's just comical. Sometimes it's destructive and dangerous. The recent story about the small group of fundamentalist Muslims in Afghanistan who destroyed a 1,700-year-old giant statue of the Buddha because their understanding of religion wasn't big enough to include it is a sad example of people who've got an elephant's toe and think the toe is the whole elephant. The overwhelming majority of Muslims in the world were embarrassed by their actions, which make a great religion look small. That's sad. Ironically, one of the best religious teachings I know of that might have helped them see the kind of religious mistake they were making is a Buddhist teaching. The Buddhists imagined a finger pointing at the moon. Just a finger pointing at the moon. What's the moon? The moon is the light and the darkness that we're looking for. The moon's this beautiful thing far away, and the finger's pointing to it. But the Buddhists taught that people get confused by this. There are too many parts to the picture. There are two parts, and they can only deal with one part. And so they look at the finger and ignore the moon. Buddhism is such a finger pointing at the moon. So is Islam. So are all religions. Many different fingers pointing at the moon. We're supposed to see the moon, the light and the darkness. Instead, we just see the finger, and that would be comical if it weren't so destructive. People worshiping one finger destroyed the pointing finger of another religion and never noticed the moon at all. We see the self-mutilation of the body of humanity. One part harming another part because they can't see that they're all parts of the same thing. Just fingers, no moons. If you'd like something less poetic and more scientific than this metaphor, there's a medical example of this too. It's called cancer. Cancer cells are cells that only reproduce their own kind of cells without any feeling for or connection to the interdependence of the whole organism. As a result, the more successful cancer cells are at reproducing only their own kind, the more unhealthy the whole body gets until at last it dies and they die with it. The vision was too small to sustain a whole body. There's also an old story about the devil. I don't know what religion it came from, but you'll probably recognize it. A messenger came to the devil one day, and he was agitated. He had news that a group of people on earth had actually discovered a small piece of the truth. The devil wasn't worried. "But," said the messenger, "the truth is your mortal enemy. Why don't you want to stop them?" "Because," the devil laughed, "when people find a small piece of the truth, they turn it into an idol and worship it. Then in the name of that idol, they will commit every devilish act imaginable. They work for me." You see a finger pointing at the moon, but it isn't the finger of one of your group, so you cut it off. You dynamite the statue of another religion because you don't understand that you only had a little piece of the truth after all. And that statue had acted for centuries as a finger pointing different people to different parts of the truth. You've got the toe of an elephant, and you build a tiny toe-sized box around it to make a sacred shrine for it, to shut it off from the rest of the world, And then the elephant dies because it can't be fit in a toe-sized box. These stories, and hundreds more like them, draw a picture of the problem that has plagued all religions since religions began. Because something in us wants to be small. And this is the kind of problem to which this new American style of spirituality may be the best kind of solution in history. Because when most of us shrug off the narrow offerings of this or that religious orthodoxy, it is almost never because we are not religious. It is almost always because something deep inside of us knows that a religious orthodoxy is like a toe-sized box for an elephant. This new eclecticism that's been emerging in our society for a generation or so has arisen among people who want and need to get a glimpse of the moon, the elephant. And they aren't as easily seduced by any religion's beckoning finger as we used to be. We feel the need for a sense of wholeness, of authenticity, of connection, and we have the freedom and the courage to say we don't want what won't get us there, no matter how many centuries people have been saying or doing it. That isn't the absence of religion. That's the spirit and soul of religion, breaking free from centuries of incrustation that would cram a whole elephant into a box that big. For decades, religious apologists have been saying, and I heard this all through graduate school 20 years ago, religious apologists have been saying that nobody can just be generically religious. That we have to be religious within a particular tradition, and almost always it just happens to be theirs. It would be amazingly lucky for them if they were right. But it isn't true. Today, in a world with so many different religions, each of which has only a piece of the truth, the only adequate spiritual path has to transcend the boundaries of every single religion. That's new. There was this woman who loved the Buddha so much that she had a gold-plated statue of the Buddha made, and she carried it with her everywhere. As she lit the incense to offer pleasing scents to her beloved Buddha, she noticed that some of the incense reached her golden Buddha, but most of the smoke and smell blew over around all the other Buddha statues that people were using for their own little shrines. She was sure, as people almost always seem to be sure, that only her Buddha was worthy of devotion. So she made a little funnel to place over her incense and to make all the incense and all the smoke go up only to her Buddha's nose. The smoke blackened the nose of her Buddha, making it especially ugly. There's a wonderful new style of being religious in our society, which is the antidote to this timeless story of how narrow devotion can make even beautiful religions look ugly. It's this open, trusting, non-orthodox style that I've called an American spirituality. I don't care whether you call it an American spirituality. You can find parts of it everywhere. I don't much care what we call it, so long as we can call it forth. It is not a respecter of small boundaries, and it is not a worshiper of small symbols. We can sniff for incense from anywhere, feed from all spiritual kettles, and offer the food we find back out to all those others who are hungry too. I'll even share my hot air. Because we know that we are all parts of the body of humanity, And that unless the whole body is healthy, we can't be healthy either, and we can't be whole. All it takes is trust, a generous heart, a willingness to seek food when we're hungry and share what we have to offer with others. Those others are a lot like us. In fact, as we learn to identify with the body of humanity, they are us, and we are them. This kind of spiritual openness is like the circulatory system in the body of humanity, rather than a little toe-sized box. It opens wide fields for the elephant to roam rather than trying to imprison it in our understandings. That's a spiritual ambition that's worthy of us. I don't believe we can ask any more than this of others, or expect any less than this from ourselves. Whatever a poetic phrase like the kingdom of heaven could mean in the 21st century, it could start here. It could start with us.